Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, City Council's Tiawana Brown and her daughters are indicted for alleged fraud in obtaining COVID relief funds. The state auditor launches an investigation into City Council's settlement with CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings. He says the public should know the amount of that payout. All this as a newly appointed member of council takes their seat. And this week marked the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Mecklenburg Declaration of Independence. And of course, there is the county budget to talk about ice activity and one winning hockey team to tell you about. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News senior editor Eli Portillo. Hunter Sines is with us. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV. Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back.
Morning.
Nice to see you.
It's morning. Friday.
After weeks of trouble swirling around Charlotte City Council, yesterday the U.S. Department of Justice announced a federal grand jury had returned a criminal indictment charging Charlotte City Councilwoman Tiawana Brown and her two daughters with wire fraud conspiracy and wire fraud in connection with COVID pandemic relief funds. Russ Ferguson is the U.S. attorney for the Western District of North Carolina.
She attached IRS forms that were not real and not actually submitted to the IRS, made false statements on the applications, and got taxpayer money in return.
That's Russ Ferguson on Charlotte Talks yesterday talking about the charges levied against Tiawana Brown and her two daughters. What else do we know about these allegations, Eli?
So these stem from applications made about four to five years ago for different disaster relief funds. The federal government greatly expanded those during the COVID pandemic, hoping to keep small businesses, especially from laying off workers. And what the government indictment alleges is that Tiawana Brown and her adult daughters made numerous false applications. One detail is that the government says they used the same fraudulent tax form, basically a fake IRS form, to show profits and losses for three different applications. This form showed that they had $106,000 worth of sales revenue for each business, that they had profits of $96,000 for each business. And based on that representation, the government made multiple forgivable pandemic relief loans to Tiawana Brown and her daughters. And then they say they misspent those funds on luxury goods and a blowout 50th birthday bash for Tiawana Brown instead of using them for business purposes and payroll.
Wow. Russ Ferguson, who took the job as U.S. attorney in March, told us yesterday that this indictment was in the works before he took office. So it was in the works by a Democratic administration. So the specter of political retribution here should not be, I don't think, considered, but who knows? These charges, if proven, are felonies. What might the penalty be were she and her daughters to be convicted of these charges?
So these are serious charges. They carry penalties of up to 20 years in federal prison. At the same time, the amount is about $124,000. That's a lot of money. But some of these COVID fraud cases, which have been prosecuted around the country, are for millions of dollars. You know, the other consideration here is that Tiawana Brown is a felon. She had served 4 years in federal prison for fraud charges in the 1990s. She's been very open about that, and it's been central to her story, this redemptive being the first formerly incarcerated person elected to Charlotte City Council. So, you know, I mean, we're a long way away from sentencing and conviction, but these are serious charges, and potentially a judge could look and say, boy, you got a repeat offender thing going on here. So it's not a speeding ticket.
Yeah, so I asked Russ Ferguson, the U.S. attorney, about the factors that go into determine determining sentencing if you are convicted of a crime like this. Here's what he told us.
In coming up with a sentence, a federal judge will generally use the sentencing guidelines, and in fraud cases, the major driver of the sentence is the amount of loss. So in other words, $100,000 fraud, you will get less of a sentence than someone who engaged in $100 million fraud. And so I don't know what the ultimate sentence will be, and a lot of that depends on, you know, whether we prove these charges and which charges we prove. And a federal judge gives a lot of time and attention to each individual defendant.
So this marks the second time in Charlotte history that a sitting city official has been indicted. The first time was in 2014. It was pretty shocking back then when then-Mayor Patrick Cannon was charged and then pleaded guilty to accepting bribes from an FBI agent to help a developer. The charges against Brown are for alleged actions that took place before she was in office. She keeps bringing that up. Of course, as Mr. Ferguson pointed out yesterday, Brown is innocent until proven guilty in court, and she released a statement early yesterday morning asserting her innocence. In that statement, she said she trusts the process, but characterized this as a political attack and a deliberate effort, this is a quote, to interfere with her reelection and silence her voice. And at a press conference yesterday, she said she paid back the portion of the loan she was responsible for.
It was paid back a few months ago. When I found out, it was brought to my attention that there may be some scrutiny going on with the application, I paid it back, $20,833.
She also said she would not resign, saying, quote, I haven't been convicted of anything. I was elected by the people and for the people. And she added this.
Unfortunately, on this day, I can say that justice don't always love people that look like me.
So is she suggesting that this is not only politically motivated, but racially motivated?
I've seen posts from Corinne Mack with the local NAACP chapter that is tying this into even the Chief Jennings investigation that we've seen, that we'll talk about later, as sort of a widespread conspiracy to attack Black leadership in Charlotte. I can't speak to that. I'm just saying that is a narrative that's being pushed by local community leaders, for sure.
Eli?
I think we should note that, you know, as you said, the former U.S. Attorney for the Western District of North Carolina, Dena King, she was a Democratic appointee, and she's also a Black woman. So, you know, I think that you might see that narrative, but I do think personally it's going to have trouble taking wings, given that the investigation started under former U.S. Attorney Dena King.
The indictment itself also mentions that she used these funds to throw a birthday party for herself. It was a $15,000 birthday party bash with a throne and a horse-drawn carriage and a DJ, and I've seen video of this now that was professionally produced, so maybe some of the money went to the production of that video. She didn't comment on that yesterday at her press conference, but she did say that she asked for the PPP loans to fund a business. She said, I was starting a new business. But PPP loans were not for new businesses. They were for existing business to pay payroll expenses to help save jobs during the shutdown caused by the pandemic. With that admission, has she hurt her case?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but there were several points during that press conference yesterday where her attorney, Rob Heroy, stepped in and basically said, we're not going to talk about that. You know, he kind of was like, we're going to save this for trial when some of those specific things came up. She wanted to defend herself, but, you know, that's the kind of thing that an attorney who is paying close attention could certainly seize on and use. But they also have corporate records. We've looked and could not find corporate records for this company, like incorporation records with the Secretary of State of North Carolina. So it's difficult to say that this started before the pandemic and then also say I was starting it after the pandemic. So yeah that's going to be tough.
So this is just beginning. Meanwhile, other troubles on city council to talk about. Several weeks ago, Charlotte City Council met in closed-door session. We've talked about this numerous times in the last several weeks to decide on a settlement for an as-yet unfiled lawsuit by CMPD Chief Johnny Jennings over text messages sent to him by former City Councilman Tariq Bakari that he says threatened his job and damaged his reputation. Damaged his reputation because those texts were ultimately leaked to the press. Council agreed to a settlement. We don't know the actual figure, but we understand it to be between $100,000 and $300,000. We don't know the figure because they will not release it. But this week, the state auditor said he would launch an investigation into this and added that citizens have a right to know the dollar figure. That seems to be a point of discussion on council. Do we have that right to know, Mary?
That is what legal experts have told me, experts including Mike Totty, who is one of the leading First Amendment lawyers in the state of North Carolina, have told me that while the city council is within their rights to approve a settlement in closed session, eventually they would, under state law, have to disclose the details of the settlement, including how much money Chief Jennings is being paid.
Eli?
And, you know, the city's way around this has been to say, well, it's not a settlement. It's, a compensation agreement of some kind with a city employee, and those records are secret under state law. The auditor has the power to compel and subpoena records from the city. So, I'd expect Dave Bullock to do that if the city won't turn them over immediately. Ironically, one minor thing I wanted to mention is the only city council member to publicly, with their name attached to it, state an amount for this settlement has been Tijuana Brown, who said it was for $300,000.
This is not the first time we've run into this, Mary. You're the local government accountability reporter here, so this is not the first time we've run into this insistence that the council cannot talk about certain things because they involve personnel matters and those by law have to be secret. This, however, seems to be on the cusp of not having to be secret. Why is this so murky? Why isn't this cut and dry?
Yeah, again, I'm not a lawyer. That being said, my understanding is that in many ways it should be cut and dry, that state law does lay out what is and isn't personnel. The state law very clearly lays out what is and isn't public in a personnel file. And by the way, the state law does say that one of the things that is public in a personnel file is how much a city employee is being paid. That is public record. So in many ways it is cut and dry based on my very limited understanding as a non-lawyer. That being said, as you said, this is not a new phenomenon. The media continued to try and get the full details on how much former city attorney was Patrick Baker was paid as he left office. That is an ongoing story. So yeah, definitely not anything new. I've reported extensively on the city's broader issues with its public record system, many people experiencing long delays getting records that they're legally entitled to. So certainly not a new phenomenon.
So State Auditor Dave Bullock made his intention to investigate known in a letter that he sent to the mayor, in which he said all of the information he has to date is from the media and that the truth of the matter remains unclear. So that's why he's launching this investigation. What exactly will he be investigating? The amount of the payout or the reason for the payout or both?
My understanding is both the totality of the circumstances, also how the vote was conducted. There's been disputes about city council members wanting to change their votes and not being allowed to, also who was counted as present and voting yes. Just to backtrack and agree with Mary, every lawyer we've talked to who's not employed by the city of Charlotte has said that this should be cut and dry, and this appears to be public based on their understanding of records law. So,
and in the aftermath of this decision by council to engage in this payout, some members of council alleged immoral, even illegal activity on council. Very quickly, in 10 seconds, is he investigating that as well?
Yes, based on that being in reference here, although the council member who said that did walk it back.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Eli Portillo is with us. He's senior editor for WFAE News. Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV. We haven't quite finished up with City Council yet, nor the investigation that State Auditor Dave Bolick says he is launching into the closed-door meeting that resulted in a payout of some amount of money to the CMPD chief. We don't know how much, and that's one of the things he's investigating, because Bolick says that even if the payment was worth one penny, it should be disclosed to the public in a timely and transparent manner. There is no tax dollar free from public scrutiny, he says. And that seems to go against, Mary, what we have been told about this and other instances of payouts by members of council and by the mayor. If he is successful, and if what he is saying is correct, that every penny has to be disclosed, could this increase transparency in the city? Will that end this, I don't know what you call it, this, will it end this practice of not telling us?
I think there is potential there. I think if Auditor Bolick is able to get this information out, if there are perhaps political ramifications for city officials in the upcoming local elections, it could trigger a change in attitude. That being said, you know, journalists are somewhat cynical by nature. So, you know, I think it sort of remains to be seen whether this will just kind of be a flash in the pan or something that can have a lasting impact.
So the state auditor, as you said, Eli, has the right to investigate this. Does he have any authority? In other words, if he finds wrongdoing, or can he exact punishment? Can he force the city to reveal the amount of money that they paid Chief Jennings?
Well, he does have the power to investigate. He has the power to subpoena records and get records from political subdivisions, which includes municipalities like Charlotte. You know, I feel like we've said between the four of us 80 times already, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know what legal remedies he would have there. Presumably, though, he's not going to do this big investigation announced with press releases and such and then not make the results public. So I would expect that would kind of be a minimum.
The initial tweets that led to all this from Councilman Bakari stemmed from an argument between him and Chief Jennings over protective vests for officers. And Wednesday was the final day of a week-long no-confidence vote by the Fraternal Order of Police on Chief Jennings. Ryan, you may not know the outcome of the vote, but if you do, what was the outcome of the vote?
I only know the outcome of the preliminary vote, that was 70%. I'm not sure the outcome of the final vote on Wednesday. I don't know that that's been released. If anybody else has that information.
Okay. All right. And finally, the Republican Party for North Carolina's 12th congressional district, which is a solidly Democratic district represented by Alma Adams in Congress, they have called the Republican Party in that district, not the state, just that district, has called for Mayor Lyle's resignation over this payout. Abdul Ali, who I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Eli, ran for mayor at one time, is the chair of the 12th District Republican Party. He says her administration is, quote, hiding behind flimsy excuses to avoid accountability, eroding trust in local government. And he adds, her failure to uphold transparency laws is a dereliction of duty and warrants her resignation. He says she is where the buck stops. But is she? I mean, she only votes to break a tie. And outside of Tijuana Brown, who has said publicly the payout was $300,000, no one else on council has come forward. They have the power.
Yeah, I mean, that gets back to our weak mayor system of government, where the buck really stops in many ways with the city manager. I mean, it is campaign season, so saying the mayor should resign by someone who once ran for mayor is not super surprising. At the same time, though, as a Dillon's Rule state, North Carolina ultimately gives power over municipalities to the legislature. So you could say the buck runs all the way up to Raleigh and, you know, folks like Dave Bolick, Republicans who wouldn't mind kicking the great state of Mecklenburg and Charlotte a bit.
Again, all of this brouhaha happened before Tariq Bakari announced his departure for a job with the Trump administration's Transportation Department in Washington. And that left his seat open on council. And this week, council, in a tie vote, broken by the mayor, chose former city council member Edwin Peacock to fill out Bakari's term. By law, they had to choose a Republican because that was Bakari's political affiliation. For those who have not been here oh so long, who is Edwin Peacock the Third?
Well, everything new is everything old is new again. Edwin Peacock was a former Charlotte City Council member, a Republican from District 6. He ran for mayor and lost that in 2013. Ironically, the person he lost to was Patrick Cannon, who the next year was the first sitting local municipal elected official indicted by the feds. And now, right as we've got the second indictment, Peacock is back after a decade of being a private citizen and watching from the sidelines. So he said he's not going to run for re-election. He is filling out this term, and the council, the mayor who cast the tie-breaking vote, seemed to want a, I would say, a known quantity versus another Bakari wild card.
Well, yes, because Tariq Bakari recommended that his wife, Christy Bakari, fill out his term, and she did make her pitch to council on why they should choose her to represent District 6.
With a potential tax referendum coming in November, you'll want someone in this seat who can build trust and navigate conversations with both this council and the General Assembly.
Every word of what she just said is true, but she also made some critical statements in the past about the court and the council's decision to settle with CMPD Chief Chennings even before he filed a lawsuit. Did those comments perhaps hurt her? It was a 5-5 vote. Did it hurt her?
Yeah, I mean, the vote broke down among the council member, or between the council members who usually vote with the mayor and those who usually have a kind of more independent block that tends to go against the mayor and maybe the consensus. So it kind of broke down along those lines.
Yeah.
But the city's had a lot of chaos, and it's only increasing right now in city government. Peacock is definitely, I mean, a known quantity, I would say a safer choice. The mayor, I would imagine, does not want a Krista Bakari on city council calling for the police chief to resign from the dais every week or so.
Well, that's interesting because it was a 5-5 vote, 5 for Peacock, 5 for Christy Bakari on council, and the mayor then broke the tie.
I have listened to many of us talking what the opportunities are, and in this case, I believe that the council supported Edwin Peacock as the next District 6 representative, and
all
so
right.
With that is my vote.
So I've done the math here. It's a 5-5 tie. How did she reach the conclusion that the council decided that Edwin Peacock was going to be the guy?
Sometimes when you know, you know.
I listened to that back on YouTube about 4 times trying to make sense of it and see what she meant. My only guess is that they had all discussed repeatedly that they, or most of them, ideally would like to select someone who was not running for re-election. And Krista Bakari hasn't officially announced, but she's likely to, and Peacock has said that he won't. So that's my only guess for what she meant by the council supporting, quote unquote, Peacock.
And Tariq Bakari clashed with the mayor on more than one occasion on council, and one would presume that his wife, Christy Bakari, holds some of the, if not many of the same opinions. Was this a way just simply to alleviate further clashes, at least in the interim, till the election?
Yeah, I mean, like we said, Krista Bakari has called for the police chief to resign. She's got her husband's both popularity and foibles attached to her name. So, you know, I mean, if you can choose a guy you know, like Edwin Peacock, who you've sat next to, versus that, I think the mayor is probably a little tired of the drama right now.
So Tariq Bakari came onto council several years ago with 2 other young members. They were hailed at the time as the Young Turks. Larkin Eggleston and Braxton Winston were the other two. None of those people remain on council now. Edwin Peacock is an old-timer, though he's relatively young, and he has connections to go way back because his father was also a politician and also ran for mayor. But does he have the connections or the clout with Raleigh to get this transit sales tax referendum approved by the General Assembly? Mary, that's one of the considerations that Krista Bakari said was important, and I think she's right.
Yeah, and that's something that Peacock brought up during his pitch to the city council during their forum a couple weeks ago as well. His messaging was a little more focused on the voter, saying that he is a born and bred Charlottean, knows District 6 very well, and if there is a referendum on the ballot, he will be a good messenger for the city to the voters in District 6 who will be pivotal to this vote.
And we've talked a little bit about the importance that the General Assembly will play in this transit vote that may or may not be coming our way, and how they feel about the great state of Mecklenburg. And so House Speaker Destin Hall was asked for his take on what's going on with these kerfuffles at Charlotte City Council. And his answer, I found it to be comical, but it's also eye-opening.
We don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about what the Charlotte City Council is doing. And usually when we are thinking about it, it's not for a good reason.
Ed Peacock is the last Republican to be elected to an at-large council seat. And District 6 is the only competitive seat on council. Are Democrats setting them up for defeat in that district now that they've given, even though he said he won't run, they've given a well-known Republican incumbent coattails?
I think it's naive to think that wasn't part of the political calculus. As you said, this is pretty much the only competitive city council district left in Charlotte. Both parties are likely to have a lot of candidates in their primaries in September. So even if they're not necessarily going to come out and say it, I think the possibility of giving somebody the advantage of incumbency who is going to run versus going with somebody who doesn't want to run was definitely part of the math for some.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Krista Bakari is probably going to run. I would say has the advantage of incumbency, even from not sitting on council. She's been a state house candidate and came close to winning last time around. She has her husband's name. And I mean, let's be honest, we're talking about municipal off-year elections. We will probably have turnout in the single digits, maybe the low double digits, maybe we'll crack the teens. If you're talking name recognition, people who know the name Bakari, which is, you know, a slightly unusual name in South Charlotte, they'll probably, half of them won't even know it's not the same Bakari.
Right. Tragic. I used to think everybody should vote. I'm not so sure anymore. The city of Charlotte is still finalizing its budget for FY 2026, and it does not contain a property tax increase. The water, stormwater, and waste fees are slated to rise this week. They were busy fine-tuning the budget and choosing which nonprofit community organizations and other financial partners they will allocate funding to. Were any decisions reached, Mary?
No, not this week. So the city likes to do this in two phases. They have a meeting where they talk about what they think they want to do, and then they have a meeting where they actually vote called straw votes, which will happen not next week, but the week after.
How much money are we talking about that goes to these organizations?
So it depends on the size of the group. In the grand scheme of a budget as big as the city of Charlotte's, it's a relatively very small proportion. That being said, you know, especially given the fact that there's not a property tax increase this year, doesn't leave as many points of contention as there were, say, last year in these budget discussions. And also, you've got a wrinkle this year where the city has changed up its policy for how it decides who gets what and who gets how much when it comes to these nonprofit financial partners. So definitely a lot that they seem to still be trying to sort out, some wrinkles to iron out in that new system.
Eli.
One thing that I thought was interesting was that one of the main folks pushing for these groups to get more money, local nonprofits, local small nonprofits, in the hearing on Monday was Tijuana Brown, and she was behind a lot of them, and I have to imagine those are going to be a little radioactive going forward in a way that they were not on Monday afternoon.
Yes, she made this comment about supporting community organizations before the indictment came down from the Justice Department on, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday morning.
Thursday.
Here's what she said.
A lot of these organizations that we're supporting and we're talking about, they're taking hits because of DEI. No one will say it, but I'll say it. They're already falling short. So now is the time for us as a council to step up and support the people that we can support in our community.
So she says she is fully committed 100% to supporting the people's budget. That's in all caps. So what is that?
The People's Budget is a document put together, I'm not sure exactly the first year, but it's been around for a little bit now. A number of local community organizations that sort of come together and put together their own version of a proposed budget. Big point of emphasis the last couple of years, and that has been raises for city employees.
Okay, and we spoke with County Manager Dina DiOrio earlier this week about their upcoming budget, and they're going to have a tax increase in all likelihood, and she said they've had to curtail their support for area nonprofits in order to design a fiscally responsible budget. So is the city taking that into consideration, the possible curtailment of financing to nonprofits by the county as they decide what community organizations they want to support? Are they taking that into consideration?
If memory serves, that wasn't something that came up during this most recent budget discussion. A lot of the city leaders' discussion was more focused on, again, their new sort of structure for deciding who gets money and who gets how much, as well as how much money the city has to go around when they're trying to put forward a budget without a property tax increase.
Ryan.
Right, and I don't want to jump ahead to the county, but since you mentioned it, and in this context, there was an interesting address from Jennifer De La Jara, who was a former CMS board member, calling on the county to, or not even calling the county, calling the county to sort of lobby corporate folks around the city to step up and fund some of these nonprofits in a different sort of partnership, in a way now that the, you know, federal funding is falling off and city and county is sort of curtailing this funding. She wants to see, you know, all these big banks sort of step up and start funding these nonprofits in the same way that they once did for arts, although that turned into an issue that ran out at some point.
And when we talked to Dina DiOrio this week, she wants the state to step up. The county budget will include a small tax increase, as we've said, but it also fully funds, the proposed budget fully funds, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools' request for funds. And she stressed that the money will go toward increasing teacher salaries, which has paid dividends in the past. And she added that Mecklenburg County is one of a handful in the state that does not receive a teacher pay supplement from the state. So I asked her why we were left out.
Because they, I think, believe that we're a wealthy county and that we can afford to provide that to our teachers. And of course, we want to be able to do that. But I think this misnomer that Mecklenburg County is a wealthy county and that we can continue to afford that is not the case. And it's just basically unfair. We should get what every other county in the state of North Carolina gets when it comes to teacher pay.
So county employees are also slated to get a pay raise, but there are some cuts, including, as I said, nonprofits and to county departments that watch over child, family, and adult services. The budget is tight. They're dealing with erasing a deficit, which they knew about last year when they passed the budget. Cuts are difficult. So when we come back, how difficult will this be for them to achieve these cuts and maintain services? That's a key question. We'll talk about that and ICE activity in Charlotte and more on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins, senior editor for WFAE News. Eli Portillo is with us. Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Hunter Sines, a reporter for WSOC-TV. And Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve, all on the panel this morning. So these, in a tight budgetary cycle where the county is feeling the need to make cuts even as they raise property taxes a little bit, how much of a struggle will this be for commissioners to achieve?
Well, most of the cuts that they are talking about are to agencies. They might sound minor, but they could have impacts. For example, you know, $1 million roughly to the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office. They're going to achieve these cuts and shave $13 million off the budget. I would say, though, they're going to struggle because it's still kind of an austere budget. And what I mean by that is the county does have reserves they could draw more deeply from. Dina DiOrio, the manager, has said we should not draw more from the reserves in order to meet operating costs because she said, you know, she's frightened by the economic prospects of a recession. I think commissioners are going to struggle with saying, well, let's dip just a little more and not make these cuts that are going to hurt and hope we can figure it out next year.
Yeah, these cuts amount to about $14 million in reductions to county departments, and they're also considering, at the same time, whether or not they should spend $125,000 to support Charlotte Pride and the Pride Parade, because several of the festival's corporate sponsors, like Lowe's, have pulled out due to the shifting political atmosphere created by the Trump administration. But Commissioner Laura Meyer says she is not in favor of funding the Pride Festival when county departments are facing reductions in funding.
I just don't think Charlotte Pride, and I'm not going to make any friends by saying this, I just don't think it's a time to spend money on a parade. And I'm not going to make any friends. I'm not going to apologize. But I do think that I don't think that is in the best interest of the whole county.
So when will they make that and other decisions?
The county is scheduled to make its straw votes next Thursday morning.
Okay. The efforts by ICE to arrest and detain and deport immigrants who have come here illegally continues nationwide. A week or so ago, there were two men arrested near a CMS school. One was allegedly a father taking his child to that school. And now many in the migrant community are speaking out against these moves and taking action. What are they doing, Eli?
Well, we've had a number of protests varying in size from, you know, a dozen people to several dozen. And then they've also been tied up in the larger protests that have attracted crowds of a few hundred in Rock Hill and a thousand or so in Charlotte. People are basically saying they want ICE to stop detentions, especially around sensitive sites like schools and preschools and churches where they've been reported. ICE has not actually gone on to CMS property, CMS has said, and they've not gone in and, you know, detained parents in the drop-off line or done anything like that. But they've been nearby, and that's unsettled people. They've also been in and around both Mecklenburg Court and Immigration Court, which immigration advocates and lawyers have said should stop because that will stop immigrants from coming and being there for unrelated court cases if they're afraid they're going to get picked up for immigration.
So ICE, the Trump administration, and proponents of what ICE has been doing are saying that this all makes the community safer because they are removing dangerous people from the streets. But some in local law enforcement say the contrary is true, and that is backed up by migrant groups on the ground. Stefania Arteaga with the Carolina Migrant Network.
These are people that are living their everyday lives, who are part of our community, that are facing significant hardships. Going around in our community, abducting people on broad daylight does not make us feel safe.
And school board member Susan Rodriguez McDowell made this comment at this week's board meeting. She said ICE needs to treat those they apprehend with dignity rather than as inherently criminal.
Being an immigrant does not make someone suspect. The type of approach that is being utilized is egregious and un-American at its core.
Has there been more ICE activity locally since the incident involving the parent of a student at Charlotte East Language Academy?
Well, that's one thing that is really complicating this entire matter, is ICE is not releasing any local or even statewide data about who they are arresting, how many people they are arresting, and what those people did to cause their arrest. So ICE has said that they are conducting an operation in the area, which includes Charlotte. But again, we've and our immigration reporter Julian Berger has been asking for months for actual data, and they have refused to provide it. So without a number of arrests or identities or saying who's arrested, there's just this vacuum of rumor and fear in the community, which continues to grow and swirl. And for all we know, they're conducting a similar amount of operations, just maybe talking about it differently. We can't say because they won't tell us.
Mary, I'm going to appoint you the federal government accountability reporter for a moment here. With all this opaqueness surrounding ICE activities and with the fact that some of these ICE agents are masked, they don't have any identification badges when they come and apprehend people, when there are questions at the federal level swirling around habeas corpus, the president's right to use that, when there seems to be a lack of due process for a lot of these people who are apprehended, which seems to go against the Constitution. Shouldn't there be more transparency about these operations from the federal government? And is there no law making them be more transparent about this?
I can't speak to what the law does or doesn't say about the transparency on this specifically.
Where are there lawyers when you need them? Every other person is a lawyer.
I can say, you know, with regard to just sort of general transparency, I think that is something that, you know, as you said, a lot of advocates are really pushing for. When you talk about the immigrant community, you may have situations where someone may not necessarily be super familiar with their legal rights in a situation. There may be some sort of language barrier in play. So definitely a lot of considerations there. And I think that's where you get people like Commissioner Susan Rodriguez McDowell, who is, you know, who's bilingual herself, has made statements in Spanish from the dais, really sort of emphasizing people wanting people to know their rights so that they know what to do if they do end up in a situation with an ICE agent. So yeah, transparency is definitely something a lot of advocates are pushing for.
And even if you are in favor of deporting people who have come here not through legal channels, this should trouble you because this is a hallmark of authoritarianism. Eli?
And just for some comparison, you know, CMPD releases quarterly statistics with how many people they've arrested, what those charges are, etc., and what crimes there have been. Mecklenburg County releases mugshots every 24 hours of who's been arrested. So it makes comparisons easy to say, okay, CMPD is arresting more people or fewer people. If ICE refuses to do that, for all we know, they're actually arresting fewer people, just doing it in different, more high-profile places. We don't know. And that's an issue when you have a vacuum of fear that is created in a community.
Hunter.
Yeah, I just wanted to note at the beginning of this administration, when they first took office, if you remember, when they were rolling out these ICE raids and roundups, they kept telling the public that it was only focused on violent criminal offenders, whether it be in this country or their home country. That's not the case anymore. And I think a clear example of that is what we had out in East Charlotte, when a man who had a daughter that went to Charlotte East Language Academy was arrested by ICE near that school while he was taking a friend to work. And he was told by ICE agents that they got the wrong guy. We could not find any criminal history on him. He's now in Georgia, where he was visited by his family. And even though they agree that they got the wrong guy, ICE has said, well, even if we get the wrong person, if there's reason to believe that they are here illegally, we have to go through the process anyways. So that's now, I think, an excuse of going even further than what they initially told the public.
Brian.
Right. And then to speak to Eli's points about the stats, I'm sure the stats are likely up. You mentioned Carolina Migrant Network. They didn't just pop up during this administration. They've been a watchdog for years and years, and they've been watching this action. But it's also the public intimidation factor of the actions. The fear is sort of the point. And I think that's what Commissioner Rodriguez McDowell was talking about. You know, we're seeing social media videos of people getting tackled into the pond in front of the courthouse and things like that. They are masked agents working in a very public manner. And I think the fear mongering is part of the strategy.
And I have to tell you, I'm old. So I went to school in the 50s and 60s, and this was the kind of activity that we were told was bad and wrong about communist societies, about authoritarian societies, and we're experiencing it here, and we should be very, very afraid of this. You also spoke with U.S. Attorney Russ Ferguson this week, Hunter, about one of his foci of attention, rounding up members of gangs like MS-13. He believes they are a cause, these gangs, of a lot of gun violence that we have been experiencing here and around the country.
We're now seeing the gangs grow exponentially by the day because they're recruiting youth and taking direction from other countries. And that is much, much harder to enforce.
So does he see a connection between this increase in gang activity and gang influence on immigrants who are here illegally and who are being rounded up by ICE? Is there a connection that he sees there? Or do you know?
I'm sure there is a connection there, because not only are people who are affiliated with gangs being arrested, charged, and prosecuted here physically, but also the whole taking orders still from other countries, their home, whether it be their home countries or others. Some of them are physically here, but I think the bigger influence is what he was portraying is that our own youth now, gangs have changed over time. They're no longer the ones spray painting areas in Charlotte. There's a more digital footprint. It's easier to reach our youth there. And that is what he and his office is seeing, even from international actors that are trying to influence our local youth here and get them part of their own gang, whether it be MS-13 or the Tren de Agua, whatever it may be.
So the money keeps being requested for Hurricane Helene relief by various people in the state government. Governor Josh Stein is on the hunt for more money. He made his proposal this week to set aside $891 million more for that effort. This is a supplemental budget request just 2 months after he signed a bill that allocated $528 million to that effort. So far, the state has spent $1.6 billion on this. Governor Stein.
Of the funds that we have the ability to allocate, about 80% have been spent. That's why I'm coming back to the General Assembly for this additional appropriations request. It's the next phase.
Hunter, how will this be, or how has this been received by the General Assembly?
The General Assembly, it seems like, was open to another bill for Helene recovery funds. I don't know if they will pass 891, knowing that the first time around with the $528 million that was passed and signed was only about half of what Stein originally wanted. They do seem open to it, though, but it is a drop in the bucket when you think about the $60 billion estimate of damage that was caused in Western North Carolina.
And when Stein was in Rutherfordton in Western North Carolina this week, he explained his request this way.
The $891 million I'm requesting will tackle the highest priority issues, areas that we cannot afford to wait for an uncertain federal assistance. It will move us forward on the path of recovery by standing up for small businesses, investing in housing, supporting debris removal efforts, repairing schools, and preventing wildfires.
But wait, wildfires? Isn't this money for Helene relief? What do wildfires have to do with this? Well, I'll let the governor tell you.
North Carolina is projected to have the highest risk of wildfires in the United States over the next year. That is a title we do not want.
So this money would go for preparations for future disasters, Hunter? Is that part of this?
Correct. We don't want insult to injury. So my understanding is that not only are millions of dollars for the rebuilding, but also preventing the loss of that new rebuild from other Mother Nature threats like wildfires.
And so, the Helene blew down millions of trees, which are drying out and becoming wildfire fuel right now. Mm-hmm. And actually, just this week, I received a message from my home insurance company saying I should consider adding a wildfire insurance rider to our policy, and that they are going to be pushing these in North Carolina. So this is the kind of thing that, you know, will hit regular people in the pocketbook too, even if they are not directly affected, these increasing natural disaster risks.
So the General Assembly is working on next year's budget even as we speak. The House version contains tax cuts, teacher pay raises, and Medicaid cuts. The House and Senate are far apart on some of these. Elias, what can you tell us very quickly?
Very quickly, the House budget really bumps up teacher pay from $41,000 as the base starting pay to $50,000, a really big increase. It also reinstates things like 10% premium for master's pay and step increases for veteran teachers. That's probably the biggest single difference. The other really big one is that the House budget delays planned tax cuts by a few years to personal tax rates in order to help pay for this big increase. The Senate's budget is more austere. It keeps those tax cuts and it barely increases starting teacher pay. So there are billions of dollars in differences between them to work out. And this is the season of year where they go behind closed doors and we kind of wait for the Pope smoke to emerge to say they've got a budget between the House and Senate.
Every year, the Trust for Public Lands goes around the the country, and they rate cities, major cities, for their parks. And once again, we ain't doing so good, to paraphrase myself. We fell from 87th last year to 90th out of 100 this year. Why?
Because many people are not within a walking distance of a park. Only 39% of people can walk to a park within 10 minutes in Mecklenburg County, and that's very low, they say.
You know, a lot, these are major cities that have been around for a long time, and some of them are going up as we're going down. I'm wondering how they're managing to change things that they go up.
Money. Spending money.
Ah, money. Well, there you go. The crux of it all. Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Hunter Sines, reporter for WSOC TV. Mary Ramsey, the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Ryan Pitkin, co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.